Hello and welcome back to the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One. It is Thursday, May 12th, May 13th. I don't know. I've forgotten. Anyways, welcome back to the show. Mark Daly, Mark Hamilton, here to recap all the latest news from around Formula One. Mr. H, how's it going? Welcome back. Tim and I missed you on Sunday night, bro. You totally ghosted us with reason, but you know, it just wasn't the same without you.
You had a great show. You did not need to be there. That's always the fear, right? Is when you miss out an opportunity to record a podcast like Tim and it goes really well. Did they need me? I felt a little bit like Lewis Hamilton at Bahrain when he had COVID at the end of the 2021 season. Sorry, the 2020 season. Like, oh my gosh, George Russell's going to kill it in that car and I'm not going to get invited back. But you guys did a great job breaking down what was less of an interesting race, although you guys found some really interesting angles to attack, but more of a fascinating race weekend.
Totally, totally. Hey, you and I have been super busy the last couple of days, and we didn't even really talk too much about the Grand Prix offline. I wanted to get your take on it. What did you think about the track itself at Miami, the Miami Autodrome or whatever they call it, the Miami Sound Machine? Maybe not that.
I'm really glad you actually asked because one, I like to talk, and two, I really want to talk about this subject. And
you're good at both of those things, by the way.
Well, so are you. I learned from the best. I was actually going to ask you almost specifically this question because you and I didn't get to have this conversation. We really haven't talked this week because we're both so busy generally. I think I have to kind of detach myself from social media a little bit because if I talk about Miami in the context of social media, I have a fairly negative perspective on the weekend. And I really got absorbed into, I think, especially a lot of the, I would say, self-declared traditionalists on Twitter, especially in the UK, who were quick to criticize every angle and every dimension of this Grand Prix, whether it was the fact that they had a beach set up with $1,000 tickets or whether they had a fake marina or they had a gondola and all these
But did you expect anything else in Miami? Come on, come on. What were people expecting? That was completely on brand, if you ask me.
It totally was. Again, you're talking about a state that is home to Universal Studios, Disney World. It's a kind of a mecca for tourism and excitement, and it's an event state, and Miami is an event city.
Right.
That's what it thrives on.
Totally.
Hosting big time events. And ultimately, I can't criticize. I don't know that I enjoyed seeing it. I wish I could have been there and experienced it in person, but I'm not going to criticize the race organizers because they wanted to do something to make their event specifically unique. Ultimately, I thought the pricing was a little bit crazy, but at the same time, they sold every ticket by the time they got to race day. And again, they have every right to monetize this event in every conceivable way. And they certainly did that. But again, if people are willing to pay for all of these added experiences once they're within the racetrack, then all the power to the race organizers for being able to monetize it in such a way. And I think a lot of people in the US especially were particularly critical about the pricing. And I think most fans probably couldn't afford a weekend at Miami. And I get that. And you know, Miami's just not necessarily for every fan. And Formula One has never proclaimed to be the motorsport of the masses or the motorsport of the people. It's always tried to frame itself as something of an elitist product, and so be it. But you and I have both also shared the best practice in the past many times that Montreal is expensive. Miami is expensive. If you live in North America, there are some really affordable races if you can get yourself to Western Europe, whether you get to Hungary or whether you get to the traditional German races, which will be back, or Spain or Britain. There are some affordable races there. So this
What about Coda, right? Even that's going to be like more affordable compared to Miami.
Totally, totally. So I didn't have a problem with the event as a whole. I did have a bit of a problem with the race in the sense that it wasn't particularly exciting, and I didn't miss not talking about it. But ultimately, I can't criticize the track because I feel like I feel like the track designers did a pretty good job of building a track with what they had to work with, right? They didn't have a blank canvas. So I can't blame the race organizers and I can't blame the track designers because they were forced to build a track in the outskirts of a football stadium and circuit. Like, I feel like it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. I didn't like the aggregate. It was a learning experience. They're probably going to resurface the track, maybe learn some lessons from Jeddah, which seems to have a perfect aggregate regardless of time of day or temperature. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was exciting. Both you and I have been looking forward to seeing this for a lot of time. I had a lot of fun consuming all the content that was coming out of it. I just can't be particularly critical. It just wasn't a super exciting race.
Yeah, you know, it was funny too, because I couldn't help but think is that the longer that race went on, I kept thinking, you know, this race really needs a safety car.
Yes, I just assumed we'd see many of them, and we didn't.
I know, and it was funny too, because I was chatting with there's a bit of a Twitter exchange between myself and I forget who it was, you know, forgive me, just the other day, and it was just kind of funny, you know, because, you know, Tim and I showed a little bit of love to George Russell for sticking out the way that he did and gambling on the safety car, and it paid off for him. And then, you know, it was funny because my take on that is that it's almost a, I don't want to say a desperation move, but I mean, George was really, it was a risk. It was a calculated risk that something was like that would happen. But I couldn't help but thinking, yeah, is this where we're at with Mercedes in 2022, that one of their drivers has to like gamble on a safety car to just try and get up a little bit higher in the points? And I guess we are. But just going back to the track itself, what I was particularly impressed with is, much like yourself, they had this area in and around Hard Rock Stadium. And somehow they were able to build a track in there. And I couldn't help but looking at the pictures like over the course of the weekend and the weeks and months leading up to it. But I was particularly impressed when I saw the first pictures from FP1 and all that. I'm just like, wow, this looks almost like, this looks too good for a street circuit.
Yeah.
You know, it looked, it had more of a, I don't even want to call it a street circuit because it's almost more of a temporary circuit, because it's, you know, it's not like they closed off a portion of downtown Miami to run this race. So I found it interesting and really cool from that point of view. But the track itself, certainly, it needs some tweaks to it. Obviously, the surface was an issue. I mean, when you're talking about things like they're repaving it during the middle of the night because the cars are just chewing up the pavement, that's just craziness. But yeah, you know, and the other thing too is that I couldn't help but thinking afterwards, like sort of maybe not right after the race, but maybe Monday, Tuesday, just kind of reflecting back on the weekend as a whole. And the question I asked myself, or the statement I was making, is that, yeah, it didn't live up to the hype, but they set the bar awfully high, that they would have needed a very, very special race to do that, to really live up to all of the hype. You know, maybe some of the things we'd seen earlier this year, like Charles and Max fighting like wheel to wheel over the past couple of laps. And after the safety car, it looked like that might happen for a couple of laps. And then ultimately, it just sort of came down to that if Charles can get close enough, and he sort of got within DRS range there with a couple of laps, it's just like, if he can do it, he's going to get one chance, and that chance never came. And then, you know, I think he finished, what was it, about 3.5 seconds off Max in the end. You can just tell he just knew that it wasn't going to happen. So, but it was what it was. It was good for what it was, and hopefully next year that they can make some improvements and the product on the track will match up with all the hype off the track. Let's put it that way.
It feels like a perfect time to actually inject a question from one of our listeners is very on theme with what we're talking about here. But McKay Mortensen, one of our great listeners, wrote to us and asked, do y'all think that continuing to race at hybrid street circuits such as Jeddah and Miami are a sustainable approach, both economically and environmentally, especially considering driver safety concerns at tracks of that nature? So you just touched on something that I think is a really interesting point, and mm-hmm. probably something we could unspool for quite a while. I don't know if anyone got the turbo analogy there, metaphor. I don't know if that's correct, but turbo spool on spool. Anyways, see, I'm going to stop.
Things
I'm
like
gonna stop
that
on
don't
stop.
Work if you have to explain them to people afterwards.
But you, that said, we'll unpack this point. You spoke a couple of minutes ago about this being more of a dedicated circuit than it is a street track. And it got me thinking, when you look at the layout, I'm not sure how much of this track is used for anything else. You know, when you take down the grandstands and you take away the concrete barriers and whatever Tech Pro barriers they may have had, which certainly weren't enough based on the criticism and feedback from the drivers, to me, this is a purpose-built track. And quite frankly, so is Jeddah. And I would love to hear from Ahmed, and I would love to hear from Nabila, some of our really great listeners from Jeddah, because I'm not sure how much of that track is actually used as a street course. Like if we go to Baku, we know that when they disassemble that track, almost the entire thing is public
roads,
right?
Yeah.
I don't know how much of Jeddah and Miami are necessarily a true street track like Monaco. I think they are dedicated, purpose-built tracks that are just happen to be in fairly dense, built-up residential or business districts, and they're constrained from a I would say a runoff perspective, simply because they don't have the space to accommodate the runoffs that you would see at a dedicated circuit. But to me, Jeddah and Miami are more a dedicated, purpose-built circuit than they are a street track. They just they're unique. So maybe calling them a hybrid is appropriate. But I think that what we're seeing is in Jeddah and I think in Miami, these are very economically sustainable tracks. We obviously know that the race organizer, Saudi Aramco in particular, are paying $50 million a year for that race to go ahead in Jeddah. And I think it's going to gain momentum in the coming years and be a very successful event. And I think based on what we've seen this year, that unless something catastrophic happens to the popularity of Formula One in the United States, I think there's certainly going to be room for Miami to thrive on the calendar. In terms of environmentally, I think that's a much, much more complex question, but I don't think it's necessarily, I think the question is more, is it environmentally sustainable to have dedicated purpose-built tracks in the countryside occupying hundreds of acres rather than a kind of hybrid track that's been wedged into a built up residential or urban area.
Well, you know, that's a great point because I mean, remember what was it last year? Or was it 2 years ago? I mean, there was talk about building a new track. Was it near Rio de Janeiro? And that the, they were going to cut down acres and acres of trees. Right. And there was like a lot of criticism about that. So, I mean, obviously the existing circuits that have been built would be grandfathered in, but I mean, just, you know, as somebody that works in land development, I mean, there are all sorts of considerations that need to be taken into account. It doesn't matter if you're building a single family home to townhouses, to condos, to towers, or big industrial sites. I mean, that whole perspective has changed. I mean, people expect more. People and society expect better. And it's not an easy question. I mean, people want to see sustainability. People want to see responsible stewardship. And people want to see things done done properly. So, I mean, I don't want to say that we won't see any new tracks. I mean, we've got a couple that are in the pipeline. Obviously, the one in Russia, that's probably not going to happen anytime in the
for a long time. I never want to see an F1 car in that country again. I'm sorry.
Well, then we got the other one that's coming online in Saudi Arabia in a couple of years, and then in Qatar
Qadiyah.
Exactly. So we'll see those. I mean, it's a little bit different. I mean, when you're in the desert, you don't have to worry about like mass deforestation and things like that because there isn't a lot of trees and things like that in those areas to begin with. But regardless, whatever the environment is, it's got its own unique ecosystem. So there's unique considerations that have to be taken into account wherever they build a new one. But I kind of like the hybrid feel to it. You know, it was interesting. Tim and I were talking about before we actually started recording the show. And I said to him, the one vibe I got from Miami, and I don't know why, was it to me, it felt like Mexico City. I just don't know why. Maybe because it had that sort of, you know, when you go through where the podium is in Mexico, when you kind of have like that left-right combo and then you come around under the start-finish, you know, just where the old stadium is, like that kind of has a temporary feel. So I don't know if that was the connection there, but I don't know. I think it was pretty cool. Like I say, I mean, being in that sort of professional area, I was just impressed what the engineers and the designers were able to do, even though the race itself didn't really quite deliver the excitement any of us wanted. But yeah, it certainly is an interesting topic to ponder.
A couple of weeks ago, one of our listeners on Twitter reached out and actually asked a question about the potential for a new race in Western Canada. And I think it was Juan Solo. And his question was, you know, F1's growing in popularity and we're seeing all these new races being added in the US and Miami and Las Vegas. Is there the possibility of seeing a new track or a new events in Western Canada? And my answer to that is it'll never, ever, ever happen.
I can't even get Formula E off the ground here. So
totally. Yeah. I don't think a country of 40 million people like Canada has enough of an economic corporate base to sustain a second event. But I think the second piece is, where would you put the track and how would you deal with the opposition? So if you look at Western Canada, if you were to build a track, to your point, you're either going to have to deforest an area, to which you would get massive, massive uproar from residents and from people within the province and environmentalists, or you would have to spend public funds making it happen, or you would have to move into agricultural reserves. So I think if you look at Western Europe, and I think if you look at parts of Canada, building a new purpose-built track would be fraught with fierce resistance. I think to your point, in the Middle East, especially where there's significant land and the environmental impact is less, I think there's probably going to be less opposition. But you know, I don't think Zandvoort ever gets built in 2022. In fact, it's fighting opposition today. I don't think Spa gets built today. I don't think Silverstone gets built today. And I think in a sense, to your earlier point, they're kind of grandfathered in because there's some historical legacy there. The tracks are built, they're paid off, they're privately owned, privately financed for the most part. But I don't see a lot of new purpose-built tracks getting built in liberal democracies in 2022.
Well, I mean, let's take where we live, for example. I mean, there's lots of great places where you could build a circuit, say, out in the Fraser Valley. But a lot of that land is in the agricultural land reserve. And that's, you're never going to get that land out. I mean, you have to have like a really, even if you have a real valid reason, it's still difficult to get that land out of the land reserve. But yeah, it is. It's fascinating to see where it's going and what the expectations of society are.
Because ultimately, F1 is entertainment. It's supposed to be fun. Did you have fun watching that race weekend?
I did, yeah. I mean, there was a lot going on. Like I say, I got to one point in the race that it needed something to happen. It needed that safety car because some of the things that were happening were kind of far and few between. And, you know, you could make the argument that it was, I don't want to say an artificial way to kind of, you know, sort of group the pack together, but it certainly added a bit of excitement. It was interesting to see Carlos and Checo fighting it out. And then, you know, Charles got interested for several laps there. And it added a bit of spiciness to the last, say, dozen laps or so of the race. So it was just unfortunate because Gasly was just kind of like wandering all over the place and then collected poor Lando. And that was it. But, you know, fortunately, there was no damage really done other than to the cars themselves and to egos. But it certainly it delivered something when the race desperately needed it.
One of the criticisms that I've had for F1 for many, many, many years is I don't like that the sport feels the need to trot out celebrities in an effort to validate its desire to be in the public eye and to be a part of the public conversation. Like I kind of got it, you know, at 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago, especially at American events, that you would try to build up the prominence of your own event, or I would say, add legitimacy to your event by incorporating celebrities into the proceedings. I felt it was a little bit nauseating last year at COTA, and I'm a Megan Thee Stallion fan. I didn't need to see her on the grid as part of that grid walk. Like,
well, you know, Martin Brundle didn't want to see her there either after what happened.
Totally. Again, if you're a fan of the sport and you want to be there and you can afford VIP passes, fantastic, but please don't trot folks out for the sake of trying to legitimize your sport. We don't need it anymore. Formula One doesn't need it anymore. And it was a little bit nauseating with just how much celebrity spotting there was during this event, and even how much of the media was swooning at the presence of celebrities in the paddock. Guys, this is Formula One is itself the absolute pinnacle of global motorsports, and the drivers themselves are global celebrities. We don't need to be fawning at the fact that there's some B-list movie star or athlete in the paddock.
You didn't feel a little bit of excitement when they wheeled out Jean-Claude Van Damme during the course
Did
of the race?
No, I didn't see that.
No, I'm just making that up. I hope that actually didn't happen. But
I feel like we've beaten Miami to death.
I do too. Well, why don't we take a quick break and a little bit earlier than usual, and then we'll come back and we'll start going through some of the news. So don't go away. After this little break, we'll go further. And that was about the most awkward dismount I ever did. So we'll leave it there. Back in a moment, guys. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
All right, well, welcome back to the show. Mark and Mark here again, as usual. You look good tonight, man. I was kind of worried about you there last week. I mean, you just going into the show, you didn't look your normal upbeat self. I mean, you really struggled through last week. So I'm glad to see you all 100% again. Yeah, it was just, I could tell you soldiered through. It was admirable. It was
good. You're putting my business in the streets, son.
Hey, there was no hiding. Did you know how many sniffles I had to edit out of that show last week? But no, I can't. Yeah. Well, you know, all the complaints about like the audio levels on YouTube is like, guys, this is the best that we got for YouTube. You know, it's just, it is what it is. Definitely. Anyhow.
Yeah. And that's a good point, right? Because we want to encourage people to watch the YouTube stream, especially live. But anyone that goes back and revisits it later, you're getting a raw, uncut interpretation. You're getting sniffles and all because we're broadcasting that in real time. Yeah. The audio that we put into the podcast, we can go back. We never edit anything out. Like what you're hearing is the conversation uncut.
Exactly.
But we have the opportunity to go out and edit out blank space and mouse clicks and things like that just to make it a little bit more professional. But I assure you, and this is one of the things that I'm really proud about, is the shows that we put out are uncut. We don't go and edit segments. We don't go and edit ums. It is as it comes out of our mouth.
Exactly. It's what they call live to tape. And that's one of the fun things that that I find about doing this show with you, is because what you see is what you get. I mean, we put an outline together.
Right.
You do, and you do a great job of it. But then we go through, we go through all these different talking points, and you never really know what you're going to get because nothing is scripted. And it's just like sometimes, oh, I wonder how he's going to react to this and how he's going to react to that. And I wonder where this discussion is going to lead us, but it's always good fun. But hey, before we get into the news itself, let's just hit a couple of other things. Let's just go over the driver standing, the 2022 Formula One World Championship. Charles Leclerc still on top with 104 points, followed by Max Verstappen from Red Bull with 85, Sergio Perez with 66 points, George Russell quietly has slid into fourth place in the Drivers' Championship with 59, Carlos Sainz after his third place in Florida last week, now on 53 points, showing a little bit of interest in the championship. Again, well, he was always interested. He just had a couple of really bad lit races where he maybe raced two laps in two races. Anyways, that's a different story. And then Lewis Hamilton rounding out the top six. Got to throw Lewis in there. You know, it just isn't the same if we didn't leave him out there, even though I said I was going to do the top five. Lewis currently on 36 points. Over on the Constructors' Championship side, Ferrari 157 points, Red Bull 151. So that, for all intents and purposes, level. And that's not a big lead in the championship, especially at this point in the season by any means. Mercedes third with 95, McLaren fourth with 46, and then Alfa Romeo rounding out the top five with 31 points. And then the fastest lap award. I thought this one was kind of interesting. So the first three races through Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Australia, fastest lap award went to Charles Leclerc of Ferrari. And then the last two races in Imola and Miami, fastest lap went to Max Verstappen. Okay, Mark, let's go over to this is a topic I think that that you can really identify with, and this is the wearing of bling and the jewelry. I don't want to call it scandal. Is it a debate? It's definitely an issue. What's the right way to describe this situation? Is it conversation?
A conversation, a crisis? What else could it be? debate?
I love it. That is perfect. I wasn't going to go quite like crisis is a little bit too dramatic, but evolving conversation. Is that what you said? I forgot.
An evolving conversation.
I like it. I like it.
I kind of want to kick the conversation off actually with a tweet, and I shouldn't say actually. So my four-year-old, by the way, has discovered the word actually. So every third word is actually. So actually, Baba, for dinner, actually, I would like pizza, actually. Like, so
there is an actually kid out there. Like, go look it up on YouTube. There was a kid one time, he got, I don't know, was it like a state fair somewhere?
Yes, in Pennsylvania. Yes, I know the one.
Yeah, that was like about the cutest thing ever.
That was adorable.
Yeah.
So here's a tweet from Will Buxton. And this is probably the best way to kick off this conversation. And I quote, in full knowledge, Hamilton's fans will disagree. This feels like a strange hill to plant your flag on. Lewis and Merck called on the FIA to apply the rules to the letter. The new racing director is doing that. You don't get to choose which rules you want to follow, end quote. So what Will is speaking to here is this evolving conversation amongst the teams, the drivers, the race directors, and the FIA about the fact that this long-standing rule in the ISC, the International Sporting Code, which prohibits certain types of jewelry from being worn in race, in practice, in qualifying, is now going to be enforced. So a couple of races ago, we go into Australia, the FIA through the race director comes forward and says, hey, we have this rule in the ISC, the International Sporting Code, prohibiting the wearing of jewelry during a race. We are now going to start enforcing this. We're going to enforce it because it's about safety. Now, again, it's been in the rule book since 2005. For all we know, it has never, ever, ever been enforced. Mm-hmm. For most of the drivers on the grid, it's not particularly problematic because for most of them, they don't wear any or a lot of jewelry. Now, the actual rule itself, if you look at the ISC Section 5, wearing of jewelry, the wearing of jewelry in the form of body piercing or metal neck chains is prohibited during the competition and may therefore be checked before the start. Now, the interesting thing about this is rings are not included. And until a few days ago, neither were watches. So body piercings, neck chains were banned. Rings and watches were not banned. In fact, when Romain Grosjean had his crash in Bahrain a couple of years ago, he was actually wearing his wedding ring. So it's being conjured up as a bit of a controversy because there's a couple of drivers in particular that are pushing back against this ban. So initially, Lewis Hamilton, obviously, if you've seen him in the paddock, he does wear jewelry. He has earrings. He has a nose stud. And a couple of other drivers have come forward and are objecting to this. So it sounds as though Lewis actually was given a two-race exception. So initially, when he was challenged and when the FIA challenged the drivers and the teams to adhere to this rule, he took his earrings out. He stated that, hey, I can't myself take my nose stud out. It's not something I can do by myself. So they gave him a two-race exception to address this. It now sounds as though he's going to push back and he isn't going to adhere to this. Meanwhile, another young driver, Mr. Gasly, wears a cross on a chain around his neck, and he too is pushing back, stating that it should be his right whether he wants to compromise his personal safety or not. So we have this bubbling controversy between the FIA, the drivers, and the teams, and Formula One. And of course, all of this has spilled out into public, and there's been accusations. Sebastian Vettel being one of them, suggesting that this seems somewhat targeted, especially towards Lewis Hamilton. So on the one hand, it's a weird thing for the FIA to drive that this is one of the things that they want to go after, that if this was important to them, why couldn't this be a conversation between them and the drivers and the teams in the offseason so this could be resolved behind closed doors? Why allow this to spill out into public in season and become a distraction? But on the other hand, we've asked the FIA for years to apply the rules in the rule book, which they didn't do last year. And we know that it just derailed the entire championship in so many ways that now that they are trying to apply the rules, they're getting this fierce resistance from some of the drivers. And I get it. If I'm a driver, if I'm Lewis and I've been in the championship since 2007 and I've been wearing earrings since 2011, which is fact. I've been wearing a nose stud since 2017, and that's a fact. And this has never been applied before why now? Especially when it doesn't have any kind of impact into the competitive spirit of the sport. So it seems like it's ill played by the FIA, even though I agree they should be applying their rules. I think it could have been done more professionally and it should have been addressed during the offseason. But I think on the other hand too, if the drivers are asking the FIA to apply the rules and the rule books are clearly defined, there should be some adherence to those rule books. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, right? Because like you said, that it seems rather targeted in the picture that I'm looking at. Lewis Hamilton, he has two watches on one arm. He's got at least one on the other arm. He's got rings on every finger that I can see because he's holding the microphone. He's kind of held in both hands. So, I mean, Lewis likes his bling, right? And it's kind of funny, but my first reaction is that, you know, if this is going to be something that they want to enforce, it's just like, okay, if it's a rule, then you have to enforce it for everybody, right? So I can understand that, okay, if Lewis is pushing back, they give him like a couple of races. Why don't they just say for everyone that come July 1st or something, that's the deadline, if you want to call it that, that starting from that date, no jewelry except for whatever the exceptions are, for rings or whatever it is, or watches, as long as it doesn't compromise safety. But then, you know, Gasly's kind of like throwing in an interesting kind of twist to it, saying, well, you know, if I know that this is, I want to wear this and I know that it could compromise my personal safety, but I'm okay with that, then should I be okay to go and race? So, I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of lawyers somewhere listening to all this, kind of like rubbing their hands and thinking, well, you know, if this happens and that, you know, kind of doing the whole Rubik's Cube of possibilities. Right. And I really don't know. And I mean, my reaction is to, first of all, I see, like, I think the discussion around Lewis is a little bit different, just considering his whole image and everything that he does. But just in general, let's just say that they have this jewelry ban for everyone, then I think that you have to make it, applicable to all the drivers. I don't think that you can have like an exception for like Pierre Gasly saying, well, you know, give me some waiver to sign. I still want to wear my chain because I just want to wear it for reasons. But, you know, there's got to be, I mean, they're obviously concerned about something that, you know, from a safety point of view, that should something ever happen, that, his safety isn't compromised when they're trying to extract him from a car, get his helmet off or whatever it might be. So I can see that. So just in general, I think that if it's there, it's for everyone. But, you know, this whole thing about Lewis is a little bit different, you know, like you say, because, you know, it seems, as Seb said, targeted. So I don't know. It's strange. It's very, I think, appropriate the way that you put it, that it seems like a conversation that was better dealt with offline, done in the off season. And, let's have these consultations to see, you know, at least test the temperature and find out, you know, what, where the drivers are, rather than, because this has been going on for about 6 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. Right. And
since the beginning of April.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you say, this is evolving with, seemingly no end in sight. In the beginning, it was just Lewis, but now you got like Pierre kind of chiming into it as well. And who knows what else. I mean, this is something that they should have floated beforehand to see, okay, this was going to work or it wasn't. And then, you know, if it wasn't going to work, it's like, is this something we really want to dig our heels in about? Or is this something that's maybe a little bit better that we just kind of let it slide by the wayside? I mean, they're obviously concerned about for a reason, from a safety point of view. It just, the whole way it's kind of, you know, popped up into the public sphere seems a bit unnecessary to me.
The definition of jewelry, I also find interesting, and I'll read this again. The wearing of jewelry in the form of body piercing or metal neck chains is prohibited. Now, within the last couple of weeks, race directors have added, as an addition to that, jewelry and underwear, and they further define jewelry as watches. So up until the last couple of weeks, drivers were also able to wear metal watches in the cockpit of a car during a race, which to me is absolutely absurd. And I don't know how often they did. I think Romain Grosjean commented recently that he himself may have been wearing a watch during that Bahrain crash last year, which I think is crazy. But again, if there's a lack of practicality about this rule, then maybe they simply need to revisit the rule. And let's remind everyone that the FIA doesn't own Formula One. It is a contractor of Formula One whose principal role is to manage safety. And clearly, for the better part of the last 17 years, while this rule existed, they didn't believe it was serious enough that it needed to be enforced. So hopefully,
why
there
now?
Could be a constructive. Exactly. exactly. And clearly, you know, we have a new president of the FIA and Mohammed Ben Salem. And I think he came in and he probably paid particularly close attention to what had happened at the end of the championship last year. And he probably watched the way that Jean Todt was running the show. And I think he's coming in and he wants to be a much more proactive, effective custodian of the safety side of the sport. And he's probably looking at the rule book. And I think, as it's been stated before, he's going through the rule book and he's asking his race directors, are these rules being enforced? Yes, no. And if the answer is no, he's asking them to enforce them. And I think what had happened is, as the season began, he was going through the rule book and he comes across this one. Hey, is this rule being enforced? And they probably came back and said, no, openly, this rule has never been enforced. And he's like, well, if it's in the rule book, if it's in the International Sporting Code, we need to enforce this rule. But to your point, maybe this is one of those things that should have happened in the off season, so they could have had a constructive dialogue with the drivers, so this type of thing doesn't spill out into the public during the season.
Yeah, it just seems better served that if they're going through it, just the bullet points are going through each one of the sections of the ISC and just wondering, okay, well, is this being enforced? Is this isn't it? You think it would have been a little bit, what do you want to call it? A little bit less clumsy if they maybe engage the services of some consultant to maybe go through each one of the points in the ISC and to decide, okay, well, this is relevant, this isn't. Maybe we should consider a rewrite of the ISC and then and take it from there, or, you know, rather than this kind of like enforce it all or don't enforce anything. So it's just, you know, in kind of a slow news week. I mean, last week we had like the big news that
VW
Group.
Don't say that. People are going to tune out. You're not supposed to say that. Podcasting 101.
Well, then I was going to tease that we got something really good coming up, but now I killed it. So we might as well just sign off and go home early tonight. But yeah, you know, it's it is one of those things. I lost my train of thought. So why don't we just go on to the the next.
Perfect timing.
Yeah, so the next one is interesting because it's been a while since we've actually had a chance to really talk about this. And so Michael Andretti is he's encouraged by receiving some direction in Miami. And this is something that we talked about it at length last summer. Obviously, there was that that whole story about Andretti Motorsport trying to buy Sauber Alfa Romeo. And ultimately, of course, that didn't go anywhere. And then it kind of popped up several months later that they are prepared to make the big jump and you know, finance the Formula One team themselves and start one up from scratch. And then it's kind of quietened down in the last, what would you say, two and a half months, something like that. So this is kind of interesting that it should pop up again. So obviously, Michael Andretti was going to be at the race this past weekend. And so, yeah, do you want to take this a little bit further, Mark, and tell us what exactly happened with Michael in Miami?
So Michael Andretti, part of the Andretti family, he, of course, himself raced in Indy. He raced for a short period of time in Formula One in the early 90s. His dad, of course, won the 1978 Formula One World Championship. So there's no question that racing and motorsports is in his DNA and is in his family's DNA. Last year, he led a group that made a effort to purchase Sauber, and either the purchase price that they were hoping to pay wasn't sufficient, or the percentage of, I would say, control that they were going to have over the team wasn't what they would consider acceptable given how much financial outlay they were hoping to make. It happened. So that, all of that said, it didn't happen. The Sauber purchase fell apart. So now they've been working to explore other opportunities to get into the sport. So a couple of months ago in February, they sent papers to the FIA indicating that they are hoping and they fully intend to put a Formula One team on the grid, that they'd had negotiations with Renault, that their car would be Renault power unit equipped. So, of course, they would be working closely with Laurent Rossi and the Alpine team. So they felt they were in a good position to bring a team to the grid. The other thing they were willing to do was pay a $200 million dilution fee. So when the most recent Concorde agreement was struck, which was back in 2020, which remarkably was almost 2 years ago, there was a clause put in the Concorde agreement indicating that if an 11th or 12th team was to join the grid, they would have to pay a $200 million dilution fee, which would be split amongst the 10 existing teams. And the reason for that being that if you add another team to the grid, you devalue the amount of money that the existing teams extract from the prize fund. So, hey, we have to split our money 11 ways as opposed to 10, or 12 ways as opposed to 10 or 11. So this team would have to pay $200 million. In the context of 2020, in the context of the pandemic, that didn't seem like an insignificant amount of money. And Michael Andretti's coming forward saying, hey, we've got a plan to build a factory. We are going to be an American-based team. We're going to run Renault power units, and we're willing to pay the $200 million. The FIA has basically iced him out and has stated, we've got more important things to deal with right now. And with the exception of McLaren and Alpine, surprise, surprise, the eight other teams on the grid have no desire and have no energy to entertain a new team at this point. And their explanation being fundamentally that that $200 million split 10 ways is $20 million, which means nothing to us. When we're getting $150 million from a crypto sponsor, or when we're getting $100 million sponsor from an American tech company like Salesforce, $20 million as a one-time fee from a new entry means nothing to us. And what Toto and what Christian have been arguing is that if we're going to add another team to the grid, it can't be a team that's simply going to come and, like a mosquito, suck financial resources out of the sport without giving anything back. That if we're going to allow an 11th team onto the grid, they need to expand the financial value of the sport. They need to add more value. So, hey, it's not us giving up a portion of the proceeds from the prize fund, but it's us earning more because you're bringing so much value to the sport. And Toto Wolff and Christian Horner simply aren't convinced that Andretti's team would be capable of doing that. And their perspective is one, that it would simply suck money away from us that we deserve because we've invested hundreds or billions of dollars into our infrastructure and our factories to be a competitive Formula One team. And we're not willing to give up our prize money to an unknown team that's joining the grid for that paltry $200 million. The other piece of this is that Liberty, who's obviously the owner, sees professional sports and they see Formula One through the lens of the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NBA. And they believe that Formula One teams themselves should be worth a ton of money. And we've heard Lawrence Stroll talk about the fact that his expectation is that a Formula One team should be worth $1 billion. And I know that seems absurd and people get really uppity when I say that, but an NHL expansion team is worth $700 million and there's 32 of those. And the global appeal of the NHL is very small relative to Formula One. So it's not unreasonable to say that a Formula One team should be worth $1 billion. So if you suddenly allow a team onto the grid for $200 million, that significantly devalues all of the other teams on the grid, which works exactly against what the teams hope to achieve and what Liberty hopes to achieve. And then the final thing I'll add as well, and somebody just said this to me as we're talking, this is a really great quote from Christian Horner. And it's kind of going back to that point I made a couple of minutes ago about teams losing money and losing prize money when they add an 11th team. He says, and I quote, "Money is ultimately going to be a significant factor. I see it as a question really for the promoter, being Liberty, that if they want more teams, they're obviously going to have to dilute their share of the fund. Because it would be unfair to expect the other teams to pay for the additional new entrants to come in indirectly. That's always going to be the conflict that you have." So Christian Horner, Red Bull Racing CEO, is stating, hey, Mr. Liberty, if you do want to add additional teams, you should be paying them out of your share of the benefits. So again, very high level, the Concorde Agreement, it basically takes all of the operating income of the sport and it splits a portion of that towards Liberty and the shareholders, and it splits a portion of that to the teams. What Christian's saying is, hey, add more teams, but Liberty, you give up from your share, not our share. So I'm probably upsetting a lot of American fans that are really eager to see a competent American entry on the grid. I'm just not convinced this is the right way to do it because I don't think it addresses the objectives that Formula One and the teams have for enhancing the value of the individual franchises that are already on the grid.
Yeah, it's interesting as well that Michael, during the weekend, he had a letter that he had with him that he took around to the 10 Formula One teams. Basically, it was he was asking them to sign a letter of support for Andretti Motorsport to come into Formula One. So the only two people that signed it was Alpine CEO Laurent Rossi and Zak Brown, the CEO of McLaren. And Zak, he's had a longstanding relationship relationship with the Andretti's, and he obviously knows them very well. And Zach had to say, quote, and he's talking specifically about Andretti Global, and Zach had to say, quote, a very credible racing team with a credible brand with the right resources. I think it is additive to the sport. That appears to be what Michael has put together. So on that basis, we are supportive, end quote. So there you go. Anyways, time for another quick break. And when we come back on the other side, there is a bit of a follow-up story to this. And we'll get to that in just a moment. So don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, guys, welcome back to the podcast. As always, Up to Speed with Formula One. Mark and Mark here. We were just talking before the break about Andretti Motorsports still trying to get into Formula One and their latest attempts to drum up some support in the paddock at the Miami Grand Prix last weekend. So one of the things that is a bit of a spillover from that story is that Mario Andretti is going to get to drive a McLaren F1 car at the 2022 United States Grand Prix at COTA in the fall. So that's kind of cool. Who would have thought that we'd see? How old is Mario now? I think he's in his early 80s now.
82.
Yeah, isn't 82. That awesome? So he's going to be able to get behind the wheel of a Formula One car at COTA here. There's a really cool picture on Twitter of Zach Brown. I'm just looking at it right now, standing with Emerson Fittipaldi and Mario Andretti on the grid at Miami last weekend. And he struck a deal with Mario to help him out with something that's on his bucket list, and that's to drive a McLaren Formula One car at COTA this year. That's going to be pretty cool. I wonder if Mario still got it. I mean, he raced for a long, long time. I mean, it was pretty cool to see him and Michael racing in Indy back. I mean, I don't know, this is in the 90s, so I mean, that's quite a while ago, but I mean, he was still racing at a very, very competitive level back then. I mean, it's just really, really cool to see. So did you want to take this one? I don't know. This next story, why you needed to drop this one. It's a little bit it's a little bit cheeky. Let's put it that way. I'd be a little bit silly about this one, but I think this one, for those of you that well, we're not going to share it on the live stream anyways. We don't have it teed up to share the screen or anything, but it's just one of those things that you can't unsee, and that's one of Valtteri Bottas's latest Instagram posts with the Finn sans clothing. Take it away. You're chuckling.
I love this post. So I was inspired to talk about this, not only because I had so many people hitting me up on social media about it this morning, but also because one of our great listeners, Connie, messaged me, and she's actually traveling across Europe right now with some family, cool, having a lot of fun. But she was dying to know what the daily consumption of this was going to be, like what your reaction was going to be. And if you haven't seen it, Mr. Valtteri Bottas, who seems to be in a much looser, friendlier, jovial state since his departure from Mercedes. When he was with Mercedes, he seemed to be very laser focused and dialed in and working on his craft. And ever since he's been with Alfa Romeo, he seems to be as equally a competent a race car driver, but he seems to be having a little bit more fun with social media. And within the last couple of days, he posted a lovely photo on his Instagram account from Aspen, Colorado. So he and his lovely significant other are visiting some parts of the United States while they're over here. He posted this beautiful landscape shot of some mountains and some trees and a flowing river. Now, what makes this photo particularly unique is that he's in the river and he's lying face down in the water without his clothes on. So you see the back of his head, his shoulders, his back, in his bottom. So he posted this, and of course it became a social media sensation right away. There are art studios that have been commissioned to produce this work on an oil canvas. And of course, everyone in Formula One had to weigh in right away. So you had all of the drivers weighing in, you had all the different media weighing in, but I thought it was adorable. I thought it was cute. I love the fact that he just seems to be in a really great place mentally and emotionally. I also love as well all of the great posts that he has of he and his significant other traveling and working out together, the tremendous amount of support he shows his significant other in her own endeavors. But I thought this was hilarious, and it was a great way to wake up and start the day. I'm not sure that necessarily everyone else would enjoy would agree, but I thought it was awesome.
I wonder if it's going to become like a little bit of a meme, like the Fernando Alonso in the camp chair. Remember that a couple of years ago?
Definitely. It just pops up everywhere.
Yeah, it pops up everywhere. Even now, Fernando sitting there in the folding camp chair on the side of the track, kind of chilling out. When did that happen? Yeah. Was that 2016, 2017?
2015,
was it even going that back? Yeah.
It was in the McLaren Honda days, because inevitably it was a byproduct of an engine failure somewhere.
Yeah, sadly it was, but that was kind of a funny moment, nonetheless. So next one, you know, we're often quite hard on Haas, but apparently now they have a merch store, which kind of surprising. Like, I've never actually looked before. Have they just never in the history of Haas F1 had a merch store, and all of a sudden they decided in 2022, hey, this is something we need to do? Or is it just the 2022 version after not really having anything to market in 2021? You know, what's the story with this one?
Yeah, this is a team that has obviously suffered in a lot of ways on the track, in the boardroom, from a PR perspective, from an HR perspective, but it looks like they're starting to right the ship a little bit. And obviously that began a couple of months ago when they excised a certain driver and a core sponsor, and they brought Kevin Magnussen back. Then all of a sudden, wouldn't you know it, people actually want to buy Haas merchandise. So they are reciprocating. They are responding to the demands of Formula One fans everywhere. And they have stood up their official online store. And Haas F1 merchandise is now available. Wasn't ready in time for Miami, although I saw a couple of cheap Haas hats for sale in some of the booths at that event on social media. But they do have a Haas store open with some limited merch, not limited quantity, but a limited amount of merch. But they've joined the party. And quite frankly, the last couple of years, it wouldn't have mattered if they had a store up or not, because I'm not convinced anyone would have bought it. But all of a sudden, they seem to have rejuvenated their brand and the perception of their team within the F1 ranks. So yeah, it's good. It's good. I'm not necessarily going to buy it, but if you're looking for some fairly affordable F1 merch, it's not a bad place to start. I'm looking right now, about $40 to $50 for a t-shirt. Shipping is very expensive, which makes me think that they're shipping this out of the US. But if you would like some Haas merch, it's now available.
There you go. You know, Kevin Magnussen's a bit of an anti-hero, so maybe he's gathering a bit of a cult following that needs some Kevin Magnussen t-shirts or whatever comes with it. Okay. Oh, I know what I wanted to do. So this is one that I guess is a story that's maybe going to unfold a little bit, but Norris McDonald is reporting that Nicholas Latifi has been fired by Williams. I mean, obviously, Nicky's had a terrible start to the season, so it was a two tweets anyways. First one says, Toronto's Nick Latifi fired by Williams F1. Two things: Williams better have a lot of money, because there will be one hell of a lawsuit, and his replacement, Nick DeFries, had better do better in that pig of a car, which is doubtful. And then the second tweet is basically, folks, nothing to see here, because it says, correction, Nick Latifi will continue as a Williams driver for the foreseeable future. Information I received earlier today was incorrect. It doesn't matter how old you are, how often one learns this important lesson. Get it first, but get it right. My apologies to Nick Latifi. So that's pretty interesting that, first of all, that Norris broke that story and then walked it back pretty quickly afterwards.
Yeah, I woke up to this story this morning and multiple people were DMing this one to me. And Norris McDonald, for those of you that don't know, which is probably everyone, which is fine, is a fairly well-respected Canadian automotive journalist. So when I saw this morning, I was surprised. One, because he doesn't report on F1 a lot, and he doesn't tweet a lot. So when I saw the story this morning, I saw the blue check and I realized who it was from. I kind of had that kind of uncomfortable feeling that this might be legit. I just wasn't sure why nobody else was reporting it, and I wasn't clear how he got the story. I'm still very, very, very curious what made him confident enough to be the person that broke this story. Because when he posted that tweet, which was, I believe, at 5:42 a.m. Pacific Standard Time on May 12th, when he posted that tweet, he was obviously confident enough to know that he was going to be the one that broke that story. So I am dying to know, and we probably will never know, but I'm dying to know why he thought he was ready and in a position to break the news that Nicholas Latifi had been fired by Williams, not relieved of his duties, but straight up fired by Williams. The other thing that's interesting about that post too, is it's aggressive in the sense that he seems to have this mindset that Williams was going to immediately encounter a lawsuit, that obviously Safino, which is one of their principal sponsors, who of course is the company that's owned by Nicholas Latifi's dad, that they would be pursuing damages against the Williams team. And ultimately, when and if this happens, it's not going to be a surprise. And I think there'll be many conversations to make the transition as smooth as possible, and to kind of negate as much negative PR as possible. Ultimately, I hope it doesn't happen. I want Nicholas to be successful. He's a likable guy and he's a Canadian kid and he works hard. I want him to be successful. But what was ultimately super embarrassing for Norris is, just like you said, within a couple of hours. So that first tweet was at 5:42 a.m. He followed it up at 8:35 a.m. After causing a hellstorm online this spread like wildfire, that who's this guy breaking the story about a driver being fired when nobody else is reporting this? And for him to come back and say, correction, Nicholas Latifi will continue as a Williams driver for the foreseeable future, tells me that maybe he had a source on the inside that was just completely wrong, or he had information that he had no right to be reporting. Fascinating. But it's interesting how much damage one tweet can have in the course of a morning, in a couple of hours.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes, you know, these tweets don't land at all. And sometimes they just completely take off and they go, they just get a life of their own. But interesting that that this would come up and become a discussion so quickly. I mean, obviously Latifi's had his struggles so far this season. I mean, it hasn't looked good for him at all. I mean, a couple of things have been his fault. Maybe a couple you could argue was just a little bit of bad luck, but I don't ever recall a situation of a Formula One team pulling the plug this quickly in the season. Well, maybe Danny Kvyat. How back in 2016 that didn't. How many races was that? Because that was at Russia that year. And then, so that would have been about this time this year or of the year, because Russia used to be in the first half dozen races or so, because they replaced Kvyat with Max after Russia. And then Max wins the Spanish Grand Prix. Spanish Grand Prix is usually about the middle or third week in June. So I guess maybe now that I think about it, that it wouldn't be unusual, but it'd be unusual for Williams. I mean, Red Bull, they changed drivers at the drop of a hat. So there's that as well.
That year, you're right, 2016. So Max started, of course, he was on the B team for Red Bull with a 10th, a 6th, and an 8th place finish. So 3 points finishes. There's, of course, that retirement in Russia before he won that race in Spain where there was that, where Hamilton, depending on who you spoke to, either Hamilton collected Rosberg or Rosberg collected Hamilton. Well, ultimately, it was clearly Lewis that collected Rosberg, but the argument was he forced off the track? And through three races that year, Daniel Kvyat, who had actually started for Red Bull, you know, you look at it, his start wasn't that terrible. He had a DNS in the first race. He finished 7th in Bahrain, and he had a podium finish in his final race for Red Bull in China.
Really? That's
clearly
interesting. Yeah.
Clearly, I don't think you can necessarily, if hindsight is 2020, I don't think we can look back and argue that that was a bad move by Red Bull.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's second guessing the decision to swap out Max Verstappen and Danny Kvyat. I think I think history has ruled on that one, and there's no shred of a doubt. I think Danny Kvyat would probably even admit that they made the right call, but maybe not at the right time. Hey, before Mark, we get into the questions, there was kind of a cool graphic that you threw into the show notes, and this is kind of your thing, because this is a technical. It was just a list of all 20 drivers and what they've used in terms of components in the engines and gearboxes, etc., and who's getting close to maybe running the risk of a penalty if they have to swap out some components. And the one thing that stands out at me immediately is that, boy, the AlphaTauri guys have really been going through the components in those Honda engines. And Fernando Alonso's been pretty much switching out everything over the first several races of the year.
it's particularly alarming. And first of all, I credit Reddit because I found this great graphics there. And you know, I'll screenshot it and I'll share it on our Twitter feed as well, because I think some people will find it really interesting. But it's entitled Power Unit in Gearbox Used Components After 5 Rounds of the 2022 Season. And what it does is, like you describe, it shows all 20 drivers. And then in the chart, it breaks out the number of internal combustion engines, the number of turbochargers, the number of MGUHs, the number of MGUKs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How many components they've used, because this is relevant, because even in the world of a cost cap, teams are still limited by the number of different components they can use over the course of the season before they start incurring penalties. So back in the V8 days, for instance, teams were allowed to use 8 power units over the course of the season before they would start incurring penalties. In the new turbo hybrid world, originally it was 4. And then in the spirit of cutting down on costs, it was 3. So if you look at this chart, number of internal combustion engines used, well, for about half the grid, it's 1. But yep, half the grid now is already on their second internal combustion engine. Again, that's of 3. And if you look at Pierre, Yuki, and Fernando, they're already on their third internal combustion engine. Now, it doesn't mean that these teams can't go back and refurbish the existing ones, but it's unlikely that they would, which means that when they get to their fourth or their fifth, they start incurring penalties. And the penalties are grid penalties. So if you look at this list, and I think it's fair to share, each team gets 3 internal combustion engines each year. They get 3 turbochargers, 3 MGUHs, which is one half of the hybrid system. They get 3 MGUKs. They get 2 energy stores. So the energy stores are effectively the battery. They get 2 control electronics, and they get 8 sets of engine exhaust systems. So when you hear them talking about, and when I'm talking, of course, the media, Sky Sports, the F1 TV, Pro App, et cetera, when you hear them talking about, hey, this driver is going to take a new power unit, this new driver is going to take a new turbocharger, just be aware that as the season progresses, that becomes more and more consequential, especially for drivers that are fighting for the championship, because you might get to the point 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through the season where, hey, I'm going to take a new power unit, knowing that I'm going to take a grid penalty, but that's a specific tactical advantage for me because this is the track where I typically perform well versus taking that penalty at the next race. So while they're only supposed to use 3 engines, inevitably every driver goes through 4, 5, 6, 7 through the course of the championship. They just start managing when they take those penalties very tactically, so it has less impact on their championship. But yeah, I thought to your point, it was remarkable that we have so many drivers that are already 3 deep on some of these components. And if you look at Fernando, he's already on his 3rd internal combustion engine, his 3rd turbocharger, his 3rd MGUH, his 3rd MGUK. It's pretty spectacular that he's worked through so much expensive hardware so far.
Yeah, but the other thing that I thought interesting too is you look at the Mercedes drivers, they're still on the original components of everything, except for George has had some of the gearbox components switched out. So he's on the second set of some of those parts. Max is still on the all the original parts are the same set in his power unit. Same thing. He's on his second exhaust system. So there's that, and then second sets of various transmission and gearbox parts. But then both the Ferrari drivers have basically switched out their internal combustion engines, their turbochargers, both their MGUH and MGUK. So that's kind of interesting that they've been through a couple of components here and there. I mean, Carlos obviously has had his misadventures off the track. I don't know if that has anything to do with his gearboxes and stuff, but both the Ferrari drivers are also on their third set of engine exhaust systems. So there's been a lot of work going on there as well. So Mark, let's close out the show now. We've already read through one email, and the first one was from McKay Mortensen. So which one do you want to pick next? We got a couple of left.
I think we'll start with this one. So this question is from Merdad Sarahi, and he asks, you guys talked so much last year about 2022 resetting the table in the championship. 5 races in, is it everything that you expected it to be?
You want me to take this one first? You're looking at me, so yeah, sure, I'll go first.
All you.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I mean, after 5 races, I mean, it's obvious you can say now that the championship has settled down to where it is. So it's interesting to see that Red Bull kind of struggled a little bit through the first couple of races of the season. I mean, I'm still not 100% confident that they have the reliability that they need. Ferrari was a surprise that they came back as strong as they did. I don't think anybody expected them to be as good as they were in the first couple of races. Mercedes is disappointing the way that they were. I mean, I thought of everyone that they were just going to nail it with the new regs, but obviously they're having issues with the the W13. But it is what I expected, but not really, because you still have Ferrari, Mercedes, and Red Bull at the top. It's just that the order is kind of flipped around from what we've seen over the past several years. It used to be Mercedes at the top, Red Bull in the middle, and Ferrari at the bottom of those top three teams. Now it's kind of flipped around a little bit. But the big question is, and I mean, we've tossed this around a number of times over the last several weeks, and it's just like, is Mercedes going to be able to turn it around this year? And every race that that passes, I think that becomes, that answer becomes more of a no than it is a maybe. I mean, there's still a long way to go. I mean, we're only six races into supposedly a 23 race season, but the middle of the pack, I think, gets a little bit interesting as well. Where you look at some of the other teams. I mean, Alfa Romeo certainly has surprised me. I mean, Guan Yu is a little bit of an unknown quantity, because, I mean, he's still finding his feet in Formula One. I think that despite the little slip up at the end of the Grand Prix last week in Miami, I think that Bottas has done an excellent job so far for Alfa Romeo this season. Alfa Tauri's been a little bit hit or miss. Alpine, they've been they're kind of showing something, but I think that's going to really take a little bit of time before I think that that Otmar Szafnauer really gets a hold of this team and really starts to put his imprint on that team before we see that really reflect more, I think, in results and points for that team. And they've shown flashes of something. Haas is interesting because they had a couple of really good races to start the year, and now they've kind of dropped back a little bit through the last couple of races. I know that Magnussen wasn't feeling 100%. In Australia a couple of weeks ago, and then Miami. Well, Miami was going to be a big unknown for everyone. Nobody really knew what to expect going in there, because a lot of guys were just saying that the simulator is one thing, but to actually get out here, that's another thing. Plus, you had the whole track literally falling apart on them as they were there. And then Williams is a little bit disappointing. And Aston Martin, gosh, I still don't know what to make of them. I mean, they're a little bit better than they were last year at this time, but I mean, they're not really, exciting me too much. And then McLaren, I mean, they kind of blow a little bit hot and cold. I mean, they didn't start the season too good, and they kind of had some good races in between, and then a little bit disappointing in Miami last weekend. I mean, if it was them at all, I mean, it was not really the best weekend for them. What about yourself, Mark? What do you make of the season so far?
I keep thinking back to a comment that one of our listeners made in one of our Spaces chat, Marshall, when he said, hey, what you need to look at is field spread. How closely bunched up are these cars when you get to the post-race race classification? I'm looking at the championship right now. Through five races, we've had two different winners, and we've had seven different drivers on the podium. So through five races, one third of the grid has stepped on the podium. I don't know if that's necessarily. I mean, ultimately, I'm incredibly disappointed with Williams. I felt that with a couple years under the Dalton umbrella and all the investment that they made in the team, and the fact that they could sweep away all the misfortune that was associated with their previous car and the disaster that was Patty Lowe's brief time with that team, I felt that the fresh start in 2022 with a new car was going to be productive. And, Alex Albon's been heroic, pulling that car, dragging that car into not two straight, but points finishes in two of the last three Grand Prix. I just think that team otherwise has been a horrific disaster. They should have been much more competitive. I think that Aston Martin is a horror show. I think that's disappointing. Both of these teams were bad last year. And to your point, Haas showed some flashes early on seasons, but they're not necessarily ultra competitive and they're not competing for podiums. But again, the season's still young. And I think we've seen some of these teams demonstrate that they can evolve their cars in a meaningful way. I mean, you and I were awestruck at how terrible McLaren was in Bahrain. And by the time we get to Imola, they're scoring a podium. So there's still time for these teams. But while there's a lot of time, my opinion's evolving. I was really excited after Bahrain. I was incredibly excited after Saudi. The last three races, I'm not so sure. That said, again, it's all new for the teams. They're still dealing with new wheels. They're still dealing with new cars. They're still dealing with new aero. There's a lot to work out. We knew these teams weren't going to nail it from day one. If we were confident that they were, we would already have eliminated DRS. Again, for me, it's not five races in. It's not the slam dunk success that I felt it was after two races.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think by and large that there's something very good with the new format, with the new regulations here. But I think there certainly needs to be some tweaks made to the package wherever they need to do it. I mean, the one, I think, big indication that they'll know that this new formula has succeeded is that they'll just say that, okay, from 2023, that DRS is no longer needed. If they can get these cars following close together, they can pass. You know, there's no issues there. Then I'll be convinced that this new era of Formula One is a success. I wouldn't say that the judge is out, and I'm not suggesting by any means that it's a failure. It's been anything but that. I think that it's very much a developing situation, and I'm sure they're aware of this themselves. I mean, I think that they bit off a lot in trying to do what they decided to do with the change in the format, and there was so many unforeseen things when these cars finally took to the track. I don't think that anybody expected to see the porpoising and the way that still is an issue half a dozen races almost into the season as it is, and just how that is still an issue and how they're going to fix that. So that's definitely one to watch. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm enjoying the season so far. I think there's a lot of different interesting things going on with the championship. I just hope that whatever happens, that all of a sudden one of these teams just doesn't really go off to the races and then just completely dominates the world championship. I mean, you know, heaven forbid it comes down to like we saw at Abu Dhabi last year. I mean, that was one for the ages, obviously, with all the fallout from that. I mean, that was the wrong way to end a championship in a season. But I mean, if they can keep it close and it's Charles and Max, and if somebody else is able to throw their hat in the ring there for that championship conversation for whoever, maybe it's Perez, maybe it's Sainz, whoever, that would be cool. And then it would be interesting as well to see whether or not Mercedes can close that gap to the top two teams as well. So plenty of stuff going on there.
Definitely. And I still have full confidence that it's going to work its way out. And I think that the rules and the regulations and the changes are good for the sport. The other thing that I've come to realize in the last couple of days and weeks and months, actually, I shouldn't say months, but since the beginning of the season, is that this is the first year. And full disclosure, I am a fan of Lewis Hamilton and I'm a fan of other drivers on the grid, but it's been really easy to be a fan of Lewis Hamilton. And in turn, it's been really easy to enjoy the sport since 2014 because one of the guys that you cheer for has been so successful. And it's easier to watch sports knowing that your team, your guy, is likely to compete for a title and is going to compete for podiums every single week. So one of the adjustments that I've had to make is going into every race weekend, knowing that, hey, this guy that I've cheered for 8 years probably isn't going to score a podium. And I'm working to get back to that place where I was pre-2007 when I watched Formula One, not necessarily cheering for any specific team or any specific driver, because, you know, cheering for a specific driver was kind of unique to me for this period of time that Lewis has been in the sport. But I was a fan of the sport long before Lewis was here. And to be fair, I'm a fan of Formula One before I'm a fan of Lewis Hamilton. Mm-hmm. But I need to adjust and recalibrate the way that I absorb and consume Formula One. And I need to find ways to enjoy the race, even when Lewis isn't necessarily being super competitive. And I think there are lots of things that are really fascinating. And obviously, one of the things that I've started to follow now is, hey, can Max repeat and can he get some vengeance for the fact that the title that he won last year, and we've talked about this, he won it, but it was obviously colored in a way that he wouldn't have necessarily wanted. And it was tainted because of the outcome and the way that outcome happened. But I'm looking at things like, hey, Max chasing a championship this year could be a really exciting story, or Charles chasing a championship could be a really interesting narrative to talk about for the next 6 or 7 months. But yeah, it's been an adjustment for me.
You are with Lewis where I am with Manchester United. So, you know, it can be a bit of a difficult place at times. Okay, final question comes from Alexander Norg. Question is, maybe a discussion topic for the pod. If the talk about Latifi being dropped from Williams holds water, could this be a scenario? Michael Latifi ups his already big investment in McLaren Group for an exchange for a seat for Nicholas. Considering the financial struggles of McLaren, this could be a cash injection that keeps McLaren name alive and not a takeover as suggested by the VW Group. This is an interesting one because, you know, a year or two ago, I might have poo-pooed this one and say, yeah, it's never going to happen. He's not going to buy his way in, but it's interesting, cost cap or not, reduced costs or not in Formula One. I mean, McLaren have obviously had issues, and I mean, they're one of the teams that really pushed hard for this really, really low, you know, ceiling to the cost cap. I mean, Zak Brown, going back a couple of years, I mean, he really pushed for that, saying, okay, well, we're starting, what was it, 145 or 140, and then, you know, where they ended up, I think, was $130 million. I mean, McLaren and Zak Brown really pushed for that. I mean, I don't know if there's anything really to this, but out of all the teams out there, I mean, I would say that a potential might be there just, you know, because of the financial concerns. I mean, let's not forget that they actually sold off the MTC as part of that whole, all the problems that they've been having.
I think this is an interesting question. I don't believe that, and Alexander, thanks so much for the question. You're an incredibly loyal listener and thank you for all the support. I don't think that this is necessarily a realistic outcome. I think Michael Latifi's investment in McLaren was an incredibly smart one. It's rumored or understood that he owns up to a quarter of that team. The balance of the organization being owned by the Bahraini sovereign wealth fund. So they've got all the financial backing they could possibly need. I think their road car division probably needs some additional outside investment to shore up the stability of that side of the business. But I think that the McLaren Formula One group is ultimately in a really great place. And I think some of the major sponsors that they've struck up agreements with in the last couple of months and in the last year have really, really assured their place on the grid. Now, I'm not saying for a second that they wouldn't entertain a significant cash offer from a group like Audi. I just don't think that they're in dire financial straits, to be completely honest. And I also don't believe they would necessarily be open to providing Nicholas with a seat, certainly not on the team and probably not even as a test driver. I think they've got some very specific visions for what that team is and what it should be. And I don't think that Nicholas is necessarily a part of their vision. And I don't think Zak Brown would let one of their minority owners influence the decision-making around who's going to be in their seat. And ultimately, if a seat opened up or if they needed a test driver and Nicholas was the best person available, sure, you consider him. But I don't think they would consider him strictly because Michael Latifi, his dad, owns a chunk of the team. It's a great question, though.
It is, because I think that it really sort of ignites that kind of conversation about the role of the pay driver in Formula One, in contemporary Formula One. I mean, a couple of years ago, sure. I mean, if you came with a big sponsorship package and they drove a dump truck full of money up to the McLaren factory, sure, you know, the chances are they might take you on as a driver. And I'm just using McLaren here because we're talking about them specifically, because that's the way that Alexander addressed the question. But nowadays, what with the budget being so much smaller, the budget cap being $130 million, I mean, long gone are the days of teams like Mercedes and Ferrari spending, you know, $500 million plus per year on a car. And they just can't do it anymore. I mean, I'm not really sure what some of the smaller teams were spending in those days. I mean, it was still probably in the order of hundreds of millions of dollars, but it wasn't going to be half a billion like the big teams were. So, I mean, the fact is they're all spending less money, and they probably were at least spending this before. I mean, for some teams, it's going to be in and around what they are spending already. For some teams, it's going to be a drastic reduction. I mean, I think that's in part, you know, a reflection of what we're seeing with the struggles that Mercedes has had this year, because they can't necessarily spend their way out of an issue that they're having that they could have done in the past, because the resources are limited. You know, items on the car are locked. I mean, you just can't develop them. So there's a lot of things going on there. But yeah, it's a great question. But just in general, I don't think that McLaren really was that sort of historic kind of team that you would expect to see a pay driver pop up in anyways.
No. And I want to share a story too. So for those of you that don't know, and I've been teasing this for a couple of months, we're going to do a Formula One book review podcast in June with a very special guest. We're going to line up a bunch of our favorite F1 books and talk about them on a podcast. We think it'll be a lot of fun. Now,
get the invite for this? Have I been excluded?
Oh, I'm sorry. Ooh, did you want to be a part of this? But as part of the prep for this podcast, I've actually been reading a lot of F1 books. And one of my favorites is called The Mechanic by Mark Priestley. Oh, okay. And Mark Priestley was a mechanic for McLaren during the peak of their financial extravagance. And this period was the very tail end of the tobacco era in F1. And there was a period in F1 where some of the top tier teams like McLaren, before they ran into some of their financial difficulties in the last decade or decade and a half, they were absolutely rolling in tobacco money. That money was no expense for this team. But there's a great excerpt at the beginning of this book talking about the fact that they had a test team. So Formula One teams used to have test teams. So you would have dedicated cars for testing. You would have a dedicated group or crew of mechanics for testing. And you would obviously have dedicated full-time drivers for testing purposes. And they write in this book that they had developed a new part for the car. They assumed that based on their wind tunnel and based on their computational fluid dynamics, their computer simulations, that this part was going to benefit the car, but they needed to be able to test it in the real world, which isn't something that can happen today.
So what
they did was they took the car to an airstrip with their test crew, but the track was soaking wet. So they're like, well, what are we going to do? We need to be able to get proof today. We need to be able to get data that this part that we want to apply to the actual race cars for the next Grand Prix works, but we can't do it if the track is wet. So they called up a helicopter company to fly a helicopter to the track, to fly low over the track to dry it. Like, this is where Formula One was 15, 20 years ago.
Oh my
that
God.
A team was so flush for cash that, hey, the track's wet. Let's hire a helicopter to come and dry it. So again,
does that not like, does that not like sound like something you would ask like your 5-year old to, you know, what would you like to see that would make Formula One be really, really cool? I'd like to see a big helicopter fly over and dry out the track when it's raining. You know, that's insane.
And I feel like Formula One's getting back to that period of big tobacco money. The difference is it's principally coming from big technology. So we're seeing companies like obviously Workforce and Salesforce, et cetera, sign on. And I'm also deeply uncomfortable with all these grifter crypto and NFT companies get involved with the sport. But what they're doing is pumping a ton of money into the sport. And the difference now versus 10 or 15 or 20 years ago is the teams would take all that money and they'd invest it in developing the car. Well, now, no matter how much money they earn, they can only invest $140 million in the development of the car. So the rest of it for these teams is principally pure profit, which is another reason I'm not particularly worried about McLaren, because now there's this really rigid cap and they keep signing more and more and more sponsors. So all of the money they earn above, say, $170 million, which accounts for the car development and their drivers and their top three most expensive employees, everything that they earn beyond $170 million, well, that just goes to pay off debt in his profit. So I'm not particularly worried about McLaren at this point. But again, the book, The Mechanic, written by Mark Priestley, phenomenal stuff.
Cool. Sounds like a good read. Can't wait to get my invite, or if not, I at least look forward to
it. You're going to get an invite. You're going to get an invite. I promise.
Yeah, that's just so awkward. I got to beg my own co-host here to invite me on my own podcast.
The co-host of your show, by the way, Can I be involved in an episode of my own show?
I feel like I just woken up in the Twilight Zone or something like that, but it's all good. All right. Well, that's awesome. I don't have anything else tonight unless there was anything else in the mailbag, sir.
No, I think that's good. I just want to remind everyone that you recently recorded a really great interview with Tim Haraney that we're probably going to air in the next couple of weeks. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Amber Belkin, the fantastic young Canadian NASCAR driver. That one we're going to drop, I think, on Sunday, because of course we don't have a Grand Prix this weekend. So in lieu of a Grand Prix, you're going to get a really great interview. And as mentioned, we've got some other great interviews coming up. We're going to release our book review podcast in June or July. Yeah, lots of exciting stuff. You know, our commitment this year was that we were going to create lots of great content. And I feel really good that we probably haven't gone a week this year without releasing at least two episodes. And some weeks we've done three, I think, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, looking forward to dropping some of these other ones into the feed coming up soon, especially on the off weeks when there's nothing going on in the track. It's nice to have something extra to listen to on a Monday morning. Anyways, thank you all very much for listening tonight. Thank you for all of those that popped into the live stream on YouTube. If you want to get in touch with us, easiest way to do so is on Twitter at ScuderiaF1Pod, or you send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And on behalf of myself and Mr. Mark Hamilton, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again very, very soon. Bye for now.